I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the rich get richer and the poorer get poorer. That's not a new observation, but perhaps that truism has never been more true. The ultra-wealthy have reached a height of power and influence that the world has never witnessed before, and they are using that economic might to choke out SNAP benefits, Medicaid, public schools, USAID around the world, and also end American upward mobility. Who are these new sultans who have personal fortunes that surpass the gross national product of some countries, and what do they want? Evan Osnos joins us to discuss his new book, The Haves and the Have-Yots, Dispatches on the Ultra-Rich. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead. These are the words of Joe Biden delivered in his presidential farewell address, and he's not wrong, but perhaps he was specifically talking about Elon Musk, because Musk played a significant role in getting Donald Trump elected in 2024. Musk contributed over $288 million to support Trump and other Republican candidates. His primary vehicle for support was America PAC, a super PAC that he founded, in which he received the majority of its funding from Musk and focused on voter outreach and mobilization efforts in those key swing states. Musk is just one example of the giga wealthy using their vast pool of money to shape the world to their liking. Evan Osnos joins us to discuss his new book, The Haves and the Have-Yots, Dispatches on the Ultra-Rich. He lifts the veil on the oligarchs and their lives and how their accumulation of unimaginable treasure is impacting you by distorting the economy, corrupting politics, and existing above the law. Evan Osnos, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much, Dave. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I don't want to get too hung up on Elon Musk. We could spend a whole hour just jibber-jabbing about him. But what did he get for helping Trump get elected? How important was he for the Trump election, and what did he get for that?
Well, his role both in the election and then in the presidency are literally unprecedented in American history. He gave the largest, of course, he spent more than anybody else did on the election, approaching $300 million that he spent on Trump and other Republicans. And then he got something that no wealthy donor has ever gotten in the history of American politics, in the sense that the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers, they never got an office in the White House complex or a department in the government that had the power to fire tens of thousands of federal workers, including at agencies that did business with his own companies. I think that the departure of Elon Musk after 130 or so days is a reflection of the public distaste for this. I mean, the fact that Tesla's profits dropped 71%, his personal favorability collapsed, it is an indication that it tripped a wire in the American ambivalence, tolerance to some degree of the power of money in politics. This was beyond the pale. And I think it's also worth noting, though, that he made some long-range investments in himself by being there, even though he was eventually, in effect, driven out of Washington. The Department of Commerce is considering using Starlink for a $42 billion rural broadband project. The Department of Defense is considering using his space products for the Golden Dome Missile Defense Initiative. So, not to mention a whole range of other ways in which, as I mentioned earlier, his upturning of federal agencies could pay dividends for years to come.
Yeah, he gutted the FAA, which stood in the way of him launching and blowing up rockets in South Texas, things like that.
Yeah, there were a whole series of ways in which some of the first things he did when he got into power were to eliminate things that had been a constraint on his businesses. And I think that gets to the core of what I'm really focused on in this book, which is the very strange way in which, as we've always known, money is power. But any of the decorous ways in which we have traditionally tried to insulate the presidency and the executive branch from the outright use of private power, of private money for personal gain, has collapsed. We're really in a period when the Trump administration and its allies in the private business world have essentially swamped whatever the last bulwarks were in law and culture against corruption. It's not hyperbolic to say it. We're living through something we've never seen before.
It's never been easier to bribe a president than it is right now.
Well, he's created a crypto empire, he and his sons and other family members, that is not like anything we've ever had. Even today, there was news of the president preparing to sell new crypto wallets. Essentially, they sound benign, but are in fact essentially vehicles for accumulating and storing and trading crypto assets. Look, his family is now set up in a way that they will make money on fees from the buying and selling of his coins, whether or not those coins go down in value or go up. According to an analysis in the New York Times, he had made at least $300 million so far. The family and its partners had made at least $300 million from those fees, not to mention the fact that their stash of the Trump meme coin was already worth $4 billion before the auction was complete. And that auction, you'll recall, was for dinner with the president, something that has obviously never happened in the history of the American presidency.
So, I mean, it's interesting, and you write about the yachts and how big they are and the luxury that people enjoy and what they do to maintain all this incredible wealth that they've accumulated. And that's all, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's fine and good. You want to have a massive yacht? Go for it. I don't care. But what concerns me is how, the accumulation of money, I see it like gravity, having mass. And the more mass you have, the more gravity you generate. And so they have become like black holes, super mass, tightly packed, and then distorting space-time all around it. And I'm existing as a small little, crumb floating in space, but I'm impacted by their distortion of space-time. It is distorting our economy. It's distorting our way of life. They're interfering with my rights and everything that we have in our world, even our safety. So, that's what we're, isn't that what we should be concerned about?
Yeah, I think you hit on the key point. And I like the analogy. It makes a lot of sense to me, of a kind of dark matter. This is a force that exerts pushes and pulls on the world of all of us every day, whether we're conscious of it or not. And I'll give you one example. The decision that Mark Zuckerberg, to give you one example of somebody I write about in the book, the decision that he makes on any given day about what the platform, what Facebook and other properties that they own, like Instagram and WhatsApp, what they will do when it comes to packaging you as a person and ultimately as an asset, and then selling that information to advertisers, can end up shaping your political behavior in ways you don't even know. Prime example being a case, at one point they experimented with a button, putting it on Facebook, that would indicate that you had voted. You could click that button on election day to tell your friends and family that doing.
But that's actually very valuable information, and that he could sell that and make more money. And that shapes our world. Okay, we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back, speak more with Evan Osnos about his new book out today, The Haves and the Have Yachts, Dispatches on the Ultra Rich. The Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line is Evan Osnos. He's the author of the new book out today, The Haves and Have Yachts, Dispatches on the Ultra Rich. One of the problems I think we have is how inadequate the word billionaire is. You know, it's just one letter removed from millionaire. And so people just think, oh, it's just, you know, a little bit more than a millionaire, but it's so much more than a millionaire. I remember one time Molly Ivins had written a column about Ross Perot, and it took him to task for some of his, you know, opinions and ideas. And the only thing he was mad about is that she had called him a millionaire. He says, I'm no millionaire. You just demoted me. I'm a billionaire. It's a huge difference.
Yeah, I'm glad you focused on the vocabulary, because it's actually kind of amazing. And 10 years ago, there was nobody in the world who qualified as a centibillionaire, meaning somebody who has more than $100 billion. Well, 10 years later, there are now at least 15 people who meet that description. And Dave, the current projections are that we will be living with trillionaires within the next 10 or 15 years. And that number, by the way, the timeline on the advent of the trillionaire has been accelerated. The analysts who studied this just over the last few years, because of the sharp acceleration in the accumulation of wealth at the very top, have said, you know, we thought it might be one by 2040. Now they say it's more likely to be five by 2035.
Where do you put your money? If you have $1 billion, if you have $1 million, I don't know. Where do you put the money? I mean, you don't like look at your banking app on your phone and say, oh, I have a $500 billion, you know, in my bank account. Well, you don't put it in your bank account. What do you do with all that?
Well, curiously enough, I once had a Silicon Valley CEO say to me that he had bought a super yacht, and he described it to me as, this is a quote, the best way to absorb excess capital. He explained what he meant. He said, you know, you can't really buy a $500 million house, because a $500 million house, he said, the optics are weird. It makes your neighbors and your employees unhappy. But he said, you know, the truth is a $500 million boat is pretty nice. That's his description. And look, that's the truth. That's what Jeff Bezos is spending some of his fortune on. He now has he has two yachts that travel in tandem with each other, and they cost a better part of $1 billion. And look, I think that when you are somebody like Elon Musk, who had, and it's easy to overlook this fact, he only had, only as a strange word, but he had $10 billion 10 years ago. He now has $400 billion. Nobody's ever had that much. And I swear we are living in a time in which our institutions and our law and our culture, even our psychology, has not been able to catch up to that. I interviewed archaeologists on the question of inequality, people who have studied inequality back to the Neolithic period. And as Tim Carrig, an archaeologist, said to me, we are living now in a time in which, as he put it, the people who built the pyramids were living in a less unequal society than we are.
So I've heard about sultans describing these ultra-rich people as being like a sultan, or that we're living in a new feudalism, the idea that modern society, particularly in the United States, beginning to resemble the social, economic, and political structures of medieval feudalism.
Yeah, the term sultanistic oligarchy is a scholarly description. It comes from one of the real experts on the history of oligarchy, Jeffrey Winters. And he gives a pretty fascinating description. He says that there are multiple types of oligarchy that we've seen through the ages. And one is known as civil oligarchy. And the United States, really, since its founding, would reasonably fit that description. It doesn't, you can have a democracy that also has an oligarchy. And after all, the United States was founded in, at a point in which voting was reserved for white men with property. And a civil oligarchy, of course, it means that people with great wealth ultimately are bound by the rule of law, because that is the, and they choose to respect the rule of law because it actually is better for business ultimately than a country without it. What can happen, though, is that a country in which oligarchs no longer observe the rule of law can turn into what's called a sultanistic oligarchy. And that's where one oligarch essentially becomes, as Winters puts it, the oligarch in chief, and the others basically defer to him in order to advance. Putin is the prime example, exactly. Putin is the classic example of that, of the oligarch in chief. Another relevant case to be mindful of is Ferdinand Marcos in the 1970s and 80s, who was a kleptocrat in his country and was able to steal an estimated $10 billion over the course of his tenure. But more importantly, perhaps, he also collapsed the boundaries between his personal business, personal office, private interests, and then the national assets. And so as a result, he gave, for instance, really important contracts and industries to his friends, one of his fraternity brothers. And that was a terrible decision. The impact on the economy was devastating, and they sank into their worst recession since World War II. And that's the problem of sultanistic oligarchies, is that they become essentially solar systems around one person and their whims and idiosyncrasies.
So I do want to focus on that idea about the corruption on the overall economy. So, and I think we're seeing that now with, like in this big, beautiful bill, has a lot of anti-green energy stuff in there, anti-renewables, because, you know, we have the fossil fuel influence, the billions of dollars in that area, trying to crack down on innovation and progress in new technologies that threatens what they have. Of course, you know, that only limits what we have going in the United States. China is not going to slow down on what they're doing for renewable energy, or Europe, but it hurts American competitiveness.
Exactly. It's a case in which we're no longer making decisions with our national interest in mind. If we're making decisions with the interests of a few powerful individuals in mind, I mean, that is not the recipe for wise, sound, disinterested policymaking.
Right. If Maubell was really never broken up, which was controversial at the time, then we never would have gotten to cell phones.
I think there are many parallels in American history here. And I think that it's worth reminding ourselves that we've been down this road before. In fact, you know, and in some ways that's an optimistic thing to take away from this, because during the Gilded Age in the 19th century, that term was given to us by Mark Twain in 1873. He came up with that concept that really stays with us.
But it was derisive. It was derogatory.
It certainly
was. The idea that it was only appeared to be golden, but you scratch beneath the surface and it's not.
That's exactly right. And he was talking about corruption and wealth inequality. And it's a useful contrast with the language that Donald Trump uses to describe what he says is a golden age. I think that a fair reading of this is that we're living in a new Gilded Age. And part of what that last Gilded Age taught us was that you could not allow all of this power to accumulate into the hands of so few. And that's why we had the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, which was an attempt to prevent an unsustainable concentration of wealth into the hands of a small number of Americans. I mean, it's worth remembering the words of Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court justice, who said, "You can either have democracy or wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but you can't have both."
And so we had the Gilded Age and then the Jazz Age, the Roaring Twenties. And then afterwards, of course, after the Roaring Twenties, we had the Depression. And then after the Gilded Age, we had the Progressive Era. Both of these were led by Roosevelts. One of them was Teddy and the other one was Franklin. And they were both betrayers of their class, both coming from an extremely wealthy family. And they were able to, you know, turn on that and try to reform American economy, breaking up trust and creating opportunities, also challenging, breaking up, you know, strikes also. But, you know, they were the ones that broke the circle.
Yeah, that's a really important point. That history, the concept that they were traitors to their class is actually a relevant and resonant fact today. I attended a meeting recently of the Patriotic Millionaires. This is a group of people, just like it sounds, who have high net worth and are also committed to trying to prevent the worst consequences of radical income inequality. They're in effect saying we want to pay more taxes. And so they're pushing for policy changes to do that. And one of the things that they said at their conference was, we are prepared to be traitors to our class. We think that is what's required to make this country sustainable. And look, there's also history here when it comes to some of the most successful entrepreneurs in our history who decided that it was time to give back. People like Andrew Carnegie or John D. Rockefeller. I mean, Rockefeller founded the University of Chicago. And Carnegie, of course, put libraries in small towns across the country, which we're still using today, because he realized that illiteracy was going to hurt this country and was never going to allow us to be the nation that it could be. And in a way, you know, there are some great philanthropists these days, people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, who have pledged to give away the lion's share of their fortunes and have done great good with it. But there are others in this newer generation, and Elon Musk, to use a prime example, who are not giving philanthropic donations of that scale. And it was Bill Gates who said recently, talking about the cuts at USAID, Bill Gates, former world's richest man, who said he said the picture of the world's richest man, meaning Elon Musk, killing the world's poorest children is not a pretty one. It was a pretty devastating observation.
Right, because of the cuts to USAID, no longer providing food and sustenance to some of the most devastated, drought-stricken, starving areas in the world. I mean, unnecessarily. We have the resources. There was no upside to destroying that program.
It really was a baffling and tragic moment in American political history. This was a program that was a rounding error in terms of the overall cost of what we spend every day and every year, and it was providing tremendous humanitarian good. And I think that we as Americans have an image of ourselves as a country, as a generous nation. And the truth is, we can afford to be. These are small amounts of money that are genuinely saving lives. There's been some really devastating coverage recently by NPR and by Nick Kristof at the New York Times that have documented deaths since the end of those USAID programs. And I think it is going to be a stain on the history of Elon Musk's tenure in Washington.
Elon Musk, he has a foundation. He's been cited for not giving enough money with the foundation. Also, he says his great gift to the world is Tesla, and I don't know if people would agree with that.
Yeah, he has described that as his primary charitable contribution, essentially, being the CEO of a company which is committed to preventing climate change. I think people may have a different view, but it's worth noting that theory, that in a sense that skepticism of philanthropy as an idea is not unique to Musk. There are others in Silicon Valley these days who are voicing a similar idea. And it is a really stark change from the days when Warren Buffett and Bill Gates were signing up billionaires to the Giving Pledge. And yeah, there are some who are still doing it, and I think they're worth applauding. But it's notable, and I think that's part of the purpose of this project, is to say there are many different ways to be a billionaire. And I think that it's important to recognize that history may look back on people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates
Mark Cuban.
And Mark Cuban, and recognize the contributions they're making to the country, and they may not have, history may not look as kindly on some others.
Well, some of these billionaires will argue that there will be no history, or they will write the history. So we're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break, about what do the billionaires want. Bernie Sanders wants to make being a billionaire illegal. Is that possible? And how are billionaires impacting me and you and just ordinary folk? You know, how's that happening? Give us a call. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. We'll continue our conversation with Evan Osnos, his new book, The Haves and the Have-Yachts. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Just as medieval lords owned most of the land and wealth, today's ultra-rich own a vast disproportionate share of global capital, real estate, stocks, data, companies, even to infrastructure like spaceports and private energy grids and AI platforms. The richest 1% now control more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. We're talking about this with Evan Osnos. His new book is The Haves and Have Yachts, Dispatches on the Ultra Rich. You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So let's talk about Jeff Bezos for a second. Have you heard about this giant cuckoo clock that he's building in West Texas?
I have, yeah.
It is nuts. It is a 10,000-year clock that he's building in a mountain. So explain that.
Well, he has this idea of that he wants to shift focus to the long view, a kind of almost a geological sense of time. Look, I think rich guys have had idiosyncratic projects over the years. This happens to be a pretty large one. You know, he is of the view that though he does do some philanthropy, that also his, as he thinks of it, his greatest contribution to mankind is also, as he has put it, space flight. And that's one of the reasons why he's devoting so much attention to developing his company, Blue Origin. But it gets to this puzzle, which is, we have these extraordinarily capable entrepreneurs who have built these amazing companies and generated tremendous wealth. And what are the ways that the United States can change policy and rules so that we continue to promote innovation? Nobody wants to curb that, but also not make it a binary system where we are now, at this point, taxing them at a remarkably low level. It's worth reminding ourselves that the tax code is now so easily manipulated by people at the top that Jeff Bezos, according to ProPublica, qualified for a child tax credit, even though he was a billionaire many times over, because he had was able to classify so little income while maintaining his wealth. And during the pandemic, also according to ProPublica, 18 billionaires were able to arrange their taxes and their income in such a way that they qualified for COVID stimulus funds, which is a kind of an amazing fact.
I want to go back to this clock thing that Jeff Bezos is funding. It clicks once a year and advances every 100 years, and the cuckoo emerges every 10,000 years and is a symbol of long thinking. So his view, it seems like, you know, that governments, you know, the what we think is they're like sandcastles on the beach, and the tide comes in and the tide goes out, and before you know it, that sand castle was never even ever there. He's saying, don't think about the government. He has so much wealth that he doesn't have to consider those things.
Yeah, this brings to mind one of the observations that scholars have made about people in either business or in politics who end up being so elevated in their own world, in their own institutions, surrounded by people who work for them and agree with them, that they can suffer sometimes what's known as authoritarian backlash, which is that they can become, in a sense, grandiose, so disconnected from the experience of regular people, so convinced that their specific form of intelligence is actually applicable broadly and that they're able to solve all kinds of problems and have an elevated form of thinking, that it can end up blowing back on them and causing them trouble. I had an interesting conversation with another CEO in Silicon Valley who was arguing that that is a really dangerous mindset. He sees it around him and he doesn't like it. His name's Max Levchin. He was one of the founders of PayPal. And he says, you know, this idea that we are masters of the universe who move the needle is wrong, but it is, and these are my words now, but it is very broadly felt in some circles.
Right. So thinking like that in this long time view to them, I imagine, would be like, it means nothing to crash the economy in order to get to some other long-term goal that they might have, to put on these crazy tariffs, which are bad for the economy, lay off all these people, do things that are existential threats to the United States, I would imagine, put in incompetent people in charge of the Pentagon. Why? It seems as if they're deliberately trying to rupture the country.
I think sometimes, and one of the goals in this book was to try to see the world through the eyes of the people who are making these decisions and doing these kinds of things. And, you know, I have to admit it is awfully difficult to try to inhabit the mind space that Donald Trump lives in. What would compel him to do something like, you know, appoint Pete Hegseth, a TV host, to the most important position in the military in the world? Look, I think in the end, it's not that complicated. For him, he just wanted people who would be loyal and unquestioning. And I have often thought, though, that it is a kind of thinking that is the product of having never really been accountable for your own mistakes and your own decisions. That if you have lived your life essentially avoiding consequences for the wrong call, which by some readings that is the story of Donald Trump's life, then you can come away thinking, well, what's really the harm of, say, putting Pete Hegseth in charge of the Pentagon? Or, to use another example, what's the harm about minimizing and ignoring the COVID virus when it came to the United States, telling people that it's going to disappear on its own? Because really, he lives in a world in which those kinds of harsh actual consequences just don't exist.
Let's go to a caller. Our number, 833-877-8255. David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First off, I want to say I'm a big fan of Mr. Osnes's podcast, The Political Scene, with him and his co-host. My question is, it seems to me that the Republican Party is one that really promotes a philosophy of pay to play, that you are not deserving of government services unless you can prove it or pay for it, and that the degree of wealth that you have determines the degree of help that you get from the government. And in all this research that you've done putting this book together, have you come across any strategies that perhaps the opposing party, the Democrats or people who are not billionaires, who are not uber wealthy, how do they think about fighting against this oligarchic system that seems to be taking over the country?
David, thank you for your call. Evan?
Thank you, David. Yeah, and thank you for your enthusiasm for our podcast. I'll let my co-hosts know, and we appreciate it. Look, I think that it is a real strategic question about how the Democratic Party can respond to this moment. And it's been, let's be frank, it's been really hard for them to come up with a coherent answer. The 2024 election felt like a rebuke, partly because some of the voters who they imagined would be more receptive to the Democratic Party message, maybe to Kamala Harris's candidacy, just weren't there. And so it's kind of forced the party into this self-examination, which can be productive. But I will tell you one thing that I think is very clear to me. I've been going to these Bernie Sanders rallies and seeing these enormous crowds that people are turning out. And part of that, and I found this in my interviews with them, is not that they are diehard Bernie fans. In some cases, almost all of the people who I would encounter in the crowd would say that it was their first time at a Bernie Sanders rally. These were often in Republican areas. And I think that tells you that there is an opportunity there for a message that the Democratic Party can adopt that is encompassing, that does address the what is fundamentally an obscene kind of oligarchy that clashes with our conception of the country and what we are supposed to be. I think people just find it unacceptable. But it has to be phrased in a way, and has to be positioned perhaps in a way that also allows Americans to still feel as if it's okay to get rich. This is an important point that, you know, the average American today, just deep in our DNA, wants to prosper, wants to get rich. And in a sense, the message that the Democratic Party is looking for is not one that tells people you should give up on that idea that there's something wrong about getting rich. It's actually just to give them the information and the tools to help them realize why they're not already.
But upward mobility really doesn't exist in America anymore.
That escalator has very much ground to a halt. I was struck, particularly having spent some of my career in China, when World Bank statistics showed us that, in fact, China now had greater social mobility than the United States, which is an astonishing a change and really a violation of our core national myth. And I think this is why there's something about the Musk-Trump joint venture that just clashed with people's conception of how power and is supposed to work in this country.
Well, a lot of people don't want to be billionaires. They may just want to buy a modest home. They might just want to have some money in the bank, not have to worry so much about where things are going. And I think the reason why those aspirations are unattainable now for so many is because of these ultra rich. I really want to focus in on that and hammer that point when we get back from the break. But our phone lines are open. If you want to join the conversation, please do. 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Evan Osnos is with us. You might know him from The New Yorker and other previous best-selling New York Times best-selling books. His new one is The Haves and the Have-Yachts. So let's play a voicemail we have with a question.
My name is Ned Lee, and I have a comment for the Today Show on taxing. We know that the rank-and-file conservatives are concerned about the federal deficit and the debt, and we know that liberals don't think the affluent are paying enough taxes. Why don't the Democrats make a specific proposal, say, increase the top marginal tax rate to 50% on households making above $750,000 a year? Then they could talk about how the marginal rate was 90% in the 50s and 60s when the country was doing so well. But all I hear are vague comments about tax cuts for billionaires. Democrats need to get specific. Don't you agree?
All right. So, Evan Osnos, is it a tax solution possible, reining in the billionaires? And would that help with the deficit? And do the Democrats need to have better language on this?
Well, I think that the caller is absolutely right that the center of the action here is about tax policy. The question of where that number ends up, whether it's 50%, as the caller suggests, that's more hotly debated. Look, I think that it is a fact that the 400 richest Americans today pay an effective tax rate that is half what they paid 50 years ago. But your average middle class citizen in this country actually pays slightly more in tax than they did. So it is a prime opportunity to put some of those numbers out into the public with clarity. Whether Democrats decide that the answer is raising the tax rate on highest earners, or is it some form of wealth tax, or is it some form of a transformation of the inheritance taxes? That is a bigger question, because the truth is that it's even though raising rates on the highest earners might seem as if that's going to be the way that you can address this issue. The fact is that the people who have gained the most, the really exploding levels of wealth, are not really the 1%. It's more like the 0.01%. And I mean, to be very precise about this, and you'll have to bear with me on this number, but because it takes a little while to say it, but the 0.00001%, which is about 19 people today, control 1.8% of America's wealth. And if the current trends continue, if our policy stays what it is over the next 40 years, if it continues on the same path that it followed the last 40 years, that same tiny segment of the population will end up with 18% of the nation's wealth. That's just the math. That's according to Bob Lord, who's a great tax expert. And I think it's worth keeping in mind that we're talking about folks who, in some cases, have reorganized their assets in a way that they don't actually get very much income, if at all. So making the income tax rate higher might sound satisfying as a political move, but it doesn't actually address the core of what we're talking about. That's a question of wealth, not income. And that gets you into a conversation about wealth taxes and also about inheritance taxes. Because right now, the estate tax, which used to be the way that the United States would achieve what Thomas Jefferson called an aristocracy of talent, not an aristocracy of money, you know, the estate tax has been winnowed down and narrowed so much that today, really, only a couple of thousand people a year pay it, believe it or not. And Gary Cohn, who was an economic advisor in the first Trump term, he was quoted saying to members of Congress, "Today, only morons pay the estate tax." So those may be the areas to focus on as much as income tax rates.
But when someone has that much wealth, where do you put it? We talked about yachts. You can only have so many yachts, I imagine. And what they do is they seem to buy up, suck up anything that has value, that will retain the value. And a lot of that is real estate. And I think that is one of the key reasons why we have a housing shortage in the United States, why real estate continues to go up and up and up, is because those properties are being snatched up by their ultra-wealthies and their companies. And so what it does is it drives up the price. So a middle-class earner, it really, they can't afford it.
I think it's true that real estate has become one of the very high barriers to entry to people trying to move up in that social mobility we just talked about. You know, the time it takes to start to get your first home, how hard it is to get a mortgage, all of that we know from the data has gotten much, much harder. You know, I think that this question of where people store their money also gets you into the issue of offshore financing. And there, for people who are interested in this topic, I'd recommend a book by Brooke Harrington called Offshore, which will talk you through the extraordinary way in which trillions of dollars, that's with a T, are held outside of tax jurisdictions in this country and others as a way of avoiding ending up in the Treasury. And I think one of the solutions that you hear from activists like the Patriotic Millionaires is that if you really want to try to figure out where the money is, you have to address the offshore system. I think this gets to the larger point here, which I want to really drill down on for just a second, which is that it feels to us right now as if so much of our political conversation is about scarcity. Here we are looking at the possibility of cuts to Medicaid, the possibility of the reality that USAID has been shut down because of ostensible need to save money.
SNAP. That's just SNAP benefits. That's crazy.
Exactly. Exactly. And the fact is, this country has never been wealthier. That's the data. It's absolutely obvious. It's quite clear. So it's not about the fact that we don't have the money. It's just about figuring out how to prevent it from escaping the system.
And if a person wants more wealth, one thing to do is, you know, where is the money? It's in the government. Somehow, you know, start draining off those resources and putting that into your pocket. And so when you have these oligarchs, who were able to attach themselves. So look how many billionaires have been appointed by Trump to cabinet level positions. You're going to see what's going to happen, that they're going to profit from that.
This is at the core of, I think, what is going to be something to watch over the course of the next 3 years, is that, as I described it in the New Yorker in a piece recently, we're really watching the advent of that system I described that scholars call the oligarch in chief, where you have people who are benefiting from the favors and the access to the president. And that's something that ultimately will drive this divide wider and wider. I wrote this book for a very simple reason, which was I felt as if we're living through a period in which we know in abstract terms that this kind of super wealth has been created. We know that there is historic inequality, but we often don't have a vivid, vibrant understanding of it in real terms. Who are the people and what are the choices and the lives that they're living and what are their beliefs? And my hope is that I could put this down on paper so that decades from now, historians would look back and be able to say, that's what people were doing at this time when these crucial decisions were being made or not made.
So a lot of people predict there's going to be a coming economic collapse. That's, you know, a meme online. And some of these billionaires feel that as well. They are preparing for an apocalyptic event with their bunkers that are stashed with caviar. So, I mean, I was really fascinated about your write-up about that in the book.
Yeah, this was something that really staggered me when I heard about it, was the idea that people were preparing, as one Silicon Valley CEO described it to me, as Plan B, meaning essentially a breakdown of society. And part of the reason why they have that fear is that they can read on their own platforms, the social media sites that they've created, that there is tremendous distress out there. I mean, they have the analytical tools to be able to pick up on that kind of changes in the mood. One of the founders of Reddit talked to me about the fact that before the financial crisis in 2008 or in the early stages of it, you began to see the cracks in the foundation in the comments on Reddit. And it's one of the reasons why he is alert to the possibility of a greater societal breakdown today. In fact, one of the things he has done is he got eye surgery so that he would no longer need glasses. Certainly would no longer need glasses in the event of a social breakdown, because he said, I don't want to have to rely on them if the supply chain doesn't work. And there are people who hear that, other executives in Silicon Valley, and they say that's just a moral mistake. You should be using your resources to try to prevent the worst consequences, perhaps, rather than spending it on protecting yourself in the event of a crisis.
Well, you can always move to your giga yacht and live out in the middle of the ocean for I don't know how long. They're huge. Unless have a big pantry. So is that possible?
Well, it is one of the things I saw advertised. One of the yachts that I describe in the book, it was partly marketed as a self-contained, safe place for people out in the sea that would not have to go to land for months at a time, because it could filter seawater and it could be essentially self-sustaining. So, you know, a lot of these themes come together, and part of the reason why I paid so much attention to these yachts is they are, in their own strange way, symbols of our time.
Floating bunkers. To have the haves and have yachts, you can call them a movable feast on water as well, another Hemingway work off. The haves and have yachts. Evan Osnos, thank you so much for talking to us today.
My great pleasure. Thanks, Dave, for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.